1 in Genesis chapter 5 today. We finished Genesis chapter 4. If you're familiar last week, if you're familiar at all with the book of Genesis, and you know where all the genealogies are and all the lists of names in the Bible, then you know that Genesis chapter 5, we probably won't be spending a whole lot of time there. We spent some time in Genesis chapter 5 when we were doing the chronology, because this is a big part of trying to figure out the chronology of Genesis and of the world overall and of and so many things. But that's not the purpose of this class. So we're going to look at Genesis chapter 5, at least some of the aspects in there that I think are important. And if you want to bring up anything else, that would be great too. So we are considering at this time, Seth's godly line. Now, this is the individual, my older son. This is he's named after this individual just because, first off, I like the name. Second, it is he is the first in a godly line that we can see, at least the first after Adam, of a godly line that we can see stretching all the way down to Noah. So we see that is the genealogy that we see here in Genesis chapter 5, from Seth to Enosh to Canaan and so many others. And the last few verses of chapter 4 talk about how this is a godly line, and it says there in verse 26, and as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. And so it shows that Seth and Enosh were godly people, that at least, at the very least, whenever Enosh was born, that people began to call on his name. In other words, they were willing to do what God wanted them to do in worship and in offering sacrifices and all the things that God wanted them to do in order to worship and honor him. So, one of the things that we note is that in the first couple of verses here, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. So we see the image and the likeness, similar phraseology there, the image and the likeness of God, that Adam was made in his image. And then we see he created them male and female and blessed them, and they were and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. So we see that Adam's likeness is passed on to Seth. Seth's likeness is going to be passed on to Enosh, and so on and so forth. So we all are in the image of our parents to some extent or another, aren't we? Has anyone ever told you, boy, you look so much like your mom or like your dad? Anyone ever tell you that? There's some people who look like the very spitting image of one of their parents. And so that's an interesting thing. Sometimes you see pictures of them at that particular age, and like, wow, they look like the same person. I can't tell the difference. It's funny. I show pictures of myself to my kids, and depending on how old I am in that picture, Caroline has said at some point, "Oh, that's a picture of me," or "That's a picture of Seth." So it's pretty funny that she'll do that, that my kids look a lot like me. There's no denying them. So we are in that image. And at the same time, we have a lot of our children, often we pass on some of our quirks and idiosyncrasies and hopefully our values if we're Christians and we are wanting to promote true right values, we pass them on to our children as well. And so in that sense also, they are in our own image. Of course, there are some children who totally buck that, but that's neither here nor there. All right, so made in the image of Adam, which then in turn means that Seth also carries with him God's image, because Adam was made in the image of God. And of course, we talked about that a bit several weeks ago when we talked about what it means to be made in the image of God, that we still carry that with us, as we see all the way down to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And I think verse 7 says that we are made in his image. All right. We note that in this passage, we see that the ages of, I say the firstborn, that's not necessarily the case with Adam, but the age with the child that was born, that we are following here, is mentioned here. For the most part, it appears to be children that are their firstborn son that follows that line. So that it appears to be the case here through chapter 5. Of course, their age at death, and all this helps us to determine an age for the world, and helps us to figure that out. And it's very interesting. 130, can you imagine having a child at 130 years? Now, for us, that's amazing. That's wild. But if we live to 900 years or 800 years longer, well, that's not such a big thing anymore, is it? So that's what we see with these older individuals. Now, we talked about the age that they had. And, you know, it's funny. And there are a lot of different questions on the chronology and how old these people are and how that can actually be determined through these passages. And, you know, do they have the same calendar system that we do? Do they measure a year like we do? Do they have certain other significance that these numbers represent? And these are just metaphorical numbers. Well, you know, those are all good questions, I think. But yeah.
Oh, that. The Hebrew calendar, how many months does it have in a year?
It has 12 months, but every 3 or so years it has a 13th, because it's a lunar calendar. And so because it's a lunar calendar, it tends to fall behind a bit after a while. Because it has a lunar calendar has, I think, 354 days in a year, if I remember correctly. So, of course, the year is 365, and so they try to make up for that because they recognize that the stars are in the wrong place after a few years, and the seasons are mixed up as well because the seasons are determined by our position around the sun. So the lunar calendar, if that is off a little bit, then it causes some interesting things to happen. In terms of a calendar. So if it's a lunar calendar and they didn't pay attention to the seasons and didn't do that, then it would have an issue with the chronology as well. But the Egyptian calendar, I think, had 360 days in it, and then they added a few days, they're called intercalary. They add a few days at the end of the year to make up for it that aren't any part of any month. We have one intercalary day every 4 years to make up for the fact that the year is actually 365 days and a quarter, plus a little extra, so there's some other stuff that we do as well.
The reason I ask is, you know, this fellow lived 900 years. I just wondered if the time period of a year for them.
It's close enough. Yeah. It's close enough. And it doesn't affect things to the extent that, oh, this is really 80 years. Yeah. So it doesn't affect it to that degree. And plus, we'll find out in Genesis 7 that they likely use a solar calendar. Stay tuned for that one. That one's going to be fun. So even then, it's going to be how we consider a year. All right, so there are a couple individuals on this list that are important to consider, the first being Enoch. We know about Enoch, right? You know, the funny thing is, the only mention of Enoch in the Bible, in the Old Testament, is here. And it says, Enoch lived 65 years. Well, it says he was born. But Enoch lives, in verse 21, Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. That's all it says. That he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What? But we see in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 5 that it expounds upon that a little bit more. Here's what that means. And then we also see in Jude that he was righteous enough to have made some kind of a prophecy. And so he made a prophecy, and that's talked about in Jude. That's recorded there. So some interesting things to consider for Enoch. Enoch, the most important of those passages, Enoch's prophecy in Jude talks about judgment. So, you know, that's based on what's happening in Genesis chapter 6, the first few verses. And so we'll talk about that, because sin is the secondary title for this section, and sin is escalating. It continues to escalate. We saw how much it escalates in chapter 4 with Cain murdering his brother, and then Lamech murdering someone for just, you know, wounding him and then bragging about it. And then we'll see how much violence filled the earth by the time of Genesis 6. So in Hebrews, so there's going to be judgment that comes upon them, and that judgment is going to be come in the form of the flood. But let's look at Hebrews chapter 11. And verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death, and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Right there we see more written in this passage than we do all the way back in Genesis. Now, it quotes from Genesis, but it shows us that he had walked with God. He pleased God. He was someone who did what God wanted him to do, and he was so righteous that he did not see death. Even he was taken up directly. Who's the other person in history that we know of that never saw death? Elijah. 2 Kings chapter 2. He was taken up in a chariot of fire. So, only two people that we know, not even Christ, can be put in that category because he saw death. Of course, he had to do that in order to fulfill the prophecies and in order to take sin upon him. But we find that that Elijah and Enoch were two people who were who did not see death. And that's an amazing thing. All right, another one, Methuselah. He is Enoch's son. And what's special about Methuselah?
Lived 900 years.
He was the longest person that we have recorded to have lived. 969 years, the oldest person. And he dies the same year that the flood occurs. That's an interesting thing. So there's two possibilities for what happened there. Either he died before the flood, and that's what happens there, or he dies in the flood. What do you think about that? What do you think is more likely, or do you have any speculation on that, or do you want to talk about that? I have my thoughts, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think he died before the flood.
Before the flood. Why is that?
Probably to keep him from suffering in the water.
Okay. Okay. I kind of agree with that. I think that Methuselah it's possible that he was unrighteous to the point that he had to die in the flood. It's possible. But being in Seth's godly line, he is the grandfather of Noah. So Noah is a righteous man, and he has to come from somewhere. I mean, he could be righteous on his own. That is possible. But it's more likely that it's more likely that he's righteous because he comes from a righteous line. And so Methuselah being righteous and his dying before the flood makes it quite interesting. Because then it means that, and actually this has echoes all the way up to Genesis 19. Because what is Genesis 19, or Genesis 18 really? What happens in 19, Genesis 19, do you remember? God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities on the plain, right? And in the previous chapter, in chapter 18, God is talking with Abraham about this situation. And he talks about, well, and Abraham says, will you save this area for the sake of 50 righteous people? And he says, yes, I will. Will you save this area for the sake of 45 righteous people? Yes, I will. Will you? And then he whittles it all the way down to 10. Will you save this area for the sake of 10 righteous people? And he said he would. Oh, yes.
That's when his wife turned around and turned into a pillar of salt.
Right, right. That's later.
He told them not to look at it.
That's right. Later on, his wife, Lot's wife, in Genesis 19, turns into a pillar of salt. So there's maybe one righteous person. At most four, maybe three, maybe just one righteous person in Sodom and Gomorrah. And so they are destroyed. There are only 8 righteous people on earth by the time of the flood. Possibly. And we don't know anything about his sons or his sons' wives. But we can presume that they were righteous to some extent as well, because they were saved and they were on the ark. In Methuselah, he would have been a 9th person. Perhaps his wife, too, would have been 10. Ah. So would he have saved it with that many people? If Methuselah were righteous, then that would have made it so that he died. And he died before the flood. There's no longer 10 righteous people. There's at most 8. And they are saved in the flood. The world is destroyed as a result. So that's that's how I think of it. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But I think it's a fun little thing to consider. But any thoughts on that? Sure.
So the flood, in my mind anyway, happened long before Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yes. Yes. But it shows a principle in the Bible that God will not destroy an area if there are so many righteous people there. So that must mean that God hasn't yet, since God hasn't destroyed us all, there's at least 10 righteous people. So that's good news, at least. All right. Let's see this Methuselah. Noah and his sons are born. Well, Noah's born first. And it says in verses 28 and 29, Lamech lived 182 years and had a son. And he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord had cursed." Was Noah a comfort? Being one of the last righteous people on earth, he was a comfort because it shows that the worship of God and that will continue on, that will carry on, that legacy will continue on, and that's a great thing. And then he begets, Noah begets his 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I have passages up there, verses up there, that kind of indicate a birth order for the two, for the three. Japheth, according to the New King James, or the King James anyway, Japheth was born first, then Shem, then Ham. It could be that these are triplets, but we don't know for sure. We do know that, well, at the very least, Shem was born after Noah was told about the flood coming. Okay, because we can see that that Noah spent 100 years building the ark, and Shem was, I think, 100 when his son was born 2 years after the flood. So he was born 2 years after Noah was commissioned. All right. Now, that is according to the New King James, or the King James. Japheth is maybe the second born according to other versions. There's some dispute about the wording of Genesis, let's see, about one of those passages. I think it's Genesis 10:21. Yeah. And the children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth, the elder. So that suggests that Japheth is the older. But some versions say or indicate that Shem is the older. So ultimately, it doesn't matter who is the oldest, but that's just something to consider. All right, and then, of course, many of you are familiar with that. Genesis 5 timeline, the genealogies of Genesis 5. I don't want to dwell too much on that because that's something we did a whole class on a couple years ago. Looking at the genealogy presented in Genesis 5. And we can get, again, Shem's date, the year he was born a little from a passage a little bit later. But there we are. All right. Now, next, Genesis chapter 6. Let's consider Noah's world for a moment. Noah's world, what he is having to deal with on a daily basis here in Genesis chapter 6, the first 13 verses. This is rather controversial, this section here. Let's look at the first four verses. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Oh, my goodness. How much speculation have you heard about these things? This word giants in verse 4 is translated from the Hebrew word Nephilim. So that might add to the recollection. Who are these Nephilim? Who are these sons of God and daughters of men? What on earth is going on? Well, there are three main possibilities that people usually choose from, people who are of sound mind and not jumping into conspiracy theories or ancient aliens, who will consider three of these possibilities. So let's look at these three possibilities that are present here. First one, and perhaps one of the ones that most people I've encountered in the Churches of Christ have hold to, is that the sons of God are the sons of righteous Seth, that they are the sons of that righteous line, okay, the sons of God. And the reason for that, the faithful are often called sons of God. We see that in several passages in Exodus 4:22, Deuteronomy 14:1, and Galatians 3:26, that we are called children of God, sons of God, for those of us who are following after, who are sons of the righteous Seth. Oh, just in time for the controversial bit, Sam. So we're considering who the sons of God and the daughters of men are in Genesis chapter 6. So there are, as I said earlier, there are three main options for those who are of sound mind, not trying to fall down into the certain rabbit holes of ancient aliens or anything of that nature. There are three main ideas here. The sons of God are, well, the first one is that the sons of God are the sons of the righteous Seth, his line, and that the daughters then, who would then the daughters of men be? If those are the sons of God, who would then be the daughters of men? Yeah, the daughters of Cain's wicked line. We see how wicked they were in Genesis chapter 4, and likely that escalated to the extent that we see the violence in the earth later on in Genesis chapter 6. A lot of people hold to this. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of faithful members of the Lord's church hold to this. I was taught this in preaching school, that this was the more correct option. Augustine of Hippo is one of those. Martin Luther, John Calvin also believe in this. But there are some things, you know, some problems with this view. First off, it suggests that there are two different meanings of man in verses 1 and 2. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth that daughters were born to them. So that's men as in all mankind. And then it says the daughters of men in verse 2 would then be unrighteous people. Well, it kind of has two different definitions there. And that's one of the marks or one of the strikes against this view. So there's issues with all of them. So will we actually know the right answer, which of these three options is correct? I don't think so. Not this side of paradise, anyway. But this is one of the ones that is held to by a lot of people. Do you have something, Sam?
It just really simple bit of wisdom. There's like one verse here. Yeah.
Well, four, yeah. But yeah.
Four. There's four. It's nothing is ever talked about anywhere else.
Yeah.
In this same, with all the same kind of weird, oh, wow, we could interpret it in these very strange ways, right?
Yeah.
And so the first thing we ought to do is we ought to be humble, and we ought to say there's not a lot there.
Yeah.
And but, so if we add a lot to it, we're going way too far.
By the end of this, I will tell you the reason why I think it's mentioned here. And I think it's very important. And it goes to the primary audience and the theme of Genesis, why this is mentioned here. And we'll get into that when I get through these options here. So that's the first option. The second option, or the second possibility, I don't know anyone who is, I've only encountered this idea on places that are not members of the Lord's church and some ideas here, but it's possible that the sons of God were in fact kings and rulers of the earth. That this is actually very common ancient Near Eastern phraseology that pharaohs and kings and rulers were sons of God. And so that's one of the reasons why this is mentioned here. It doesn't seem like that's the case in other places in the Bible, that terminology is used. So I'm a little skeptical on that. The daughters of men, then, would be women, and the prominence of regal polygamy, where how much the kings of that time were involved in having so many wives, which, of course, ends up being a problem later on with even the patriarchs. They're in Genesis, and of course, it comes to a head with Solomon later on. So that's an issue. Jewish scholars from the second century on, and some modern scholars believe in this. And the reason, again, many of the ancient texts refer to kings as sons of God. And we also find that there are continual reminders of Noah's monogamy, that he has but one wife. So that's a possibility. Of course, that also began with Lamech, the descendant of Cain, there in Genesis chapter 4. So there's that connection as well. So that's a second possibility. A third possibility, which I have heard from members of the Lord's Church, and part of that is because of evidence, New Testament evidence that we'll find later on. Because it does sound outlandish at first. So I'll go ahead and present that caveat. Option three, the sons of God are in fact fallen angels. And the daughters of men are human women. Who holds to this? Ancient Jewish and early Christian scholars, including Philo, who was a contemporary of Jesus in the first century. He lived in Alexandria. Josephus, we're familiar with him. Irenaeus and Tertullian, who are early church writers at the time, they believed in this, along with many scholars today, including some members of the Lord's Church. Now, what is the reason for this? This seems rather out there. And part of that is angelic beings are referred to as sons of God in several places, particularly in Job. Job chapter 1, verse 6, chapter 2 and verse 1, and chapter 38 and verse 7. They are called sons of God. And in several other places, they're hinted at that kind of idea as well in the Psalms and some other areas. And we also find New Testament confirmation of that idea in the passages I have up there, Jude 6 and 7, and 2 Peter 2, 4 and 5, seems to suggest that. Sam, are you looking that up, or are you looking something else up?
No, I'm looking up something else.
Okay. you have your, I presume, Bible app open.
Yeah.
So just considering that might be possible. So let's look at Jude 6 and 7. It says, "And the angels, who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in a similar manner to these, having given them over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." So, this is an indication that the angels, it says, who did not keep their proper domain. So one might counter and say, wait a second. Wait a second. The angels cannot marry or be given in marriage. Jesus says that, doesn't he? In Matthew and Mark, when he's responding to the Sadducees. The angels cannot be given in marriage or not. Well, the thing is, the reason why that's not a perfect argument is because in Jude, it says they left their proper domain. Their proper domain is not to be married or given in marriage. But they left that proper domain and became friendly with human women. All right, so that's a possibility. Jesus was explaining what was proper for the angels, for them not to do this. But then there's the problem, is the fact that in verse 4 it mentions that they bore children. How can an angel and a human bear children? How does that even work? Well, is that what produced the giants? Well, there's a question with that too. How does that even work? Well, it says that it also uses similar language in concerning Nimrod. He was a son of Cush. Nimrod is a mighty man in Genesis chapter 10, who is a man of renown. He is among those who was considered there. So is he one of those? So there's a lot of questions about who these people are, what exactly this is talking about. But there's a reason for it. Yes.
Well, the thought is, in my thought there is, this is similar to the old ancient Greek mythology with, I guess they call them what, demigods?
So there is some, I did encounter some scholars who tried to make that connection, that the reason why a lot of the Jewish scholars at the time were holding to this, and even some ancient Christian scholars, were holding to this was because they were trying to connect it to Greek mythology to some extent. Oh yeah, we've got that in here too. This is what that is. So some people have made that connection. So that there is that possibility. And maybe that's, you know, if this idea is true, then maybe the ideas of Titans and whatnot came from these actual events here and that's recorded in scripture. So there's a lot of different possibilities. The Nephilim are another interesting thing. We have in our New King James, it's translated as giants, right? The Nephilim is translated as giants. Why? Why do you suppose that is? Those verses help.
Probably pretty tall. Pretty good sized giants.
Well, it all starts, and I have several verses up there, but it actually starts with Numbers 13:33. Numbers 13:33 is where the Israelites, they're the 12 spies sent to spy out Canaan, right? And they go in there, they spy out Canaan. 10 of them return with a horrible report. They say, the Nephilim, the sons, and it says in parentheses, the sons of Anak, or the Anakim, which are mentioned later on. They are all over the place. And we find in Deuteronomy and some other places that these are very tall individuals. That these are big people. So that's one of the reasons. Also, we see Goliath is connected with the Anakim as well, the sons of Anak. So there are several words that are used in the scriptures that can be understood to be connected. The Nephilim and the Anakim are among them, among which Goliath was likely one of them. Actually, it says Goliath was a Rephaim. So I take that back. Goliath was a Rephaim. Oh, okay. So there's three other terms that are mentioned in Deuteronomy. The Rephaim, the Zamzumim, and the Emim. Okay? All these three are connected with being giants. And these are like the Nephilim. These are like the Anakim, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 2. That's who they're like. So, these aren't exactly the Nephilim, the Rephaim, and the other two. I want to use Rephaim because Emim, it says, this is the Moabite name for them, and the Zamzumim, this is the Ammonite name for them. So, I'm going to stick with Rephaim here. So, they are similar to the giants, to the Nephilim. Why does any of this matter? These are so many strange names. Why do we even have to talk about this? Because the reason why they're mentioned here in this passage, they were wicked and God conquered them through a flood. Jump to Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14 is the first mention of war in the Bible. It's the first mention of war in the scriptures. And several armies from the east, from Mesopotamia and some other areas, they come down and they conquer the Rephaim, the Zuzim, which is probably a shortened form of Zamzumim, and the Emim. They conquer the giants in that area. And then they come back around, and then they take Lot with them. They kidnap Lot and his family and his goods. Abram at the time, he hears about this, takes 318 of his trained soldiers and defeats the people who defeat the giants. Do you think that's sending a message to the Israelites wandering around in the wilderness at this time, who were scared of the Rephaim, of the Nephilim, of the Anakim there in that area. God destroyed most of them in the flood. Not only that, those who came, all of them in the flood, sorry.
They didn't survive the flood.
So he destroyed them. They came back somehow through the flood, the different ones, the Rephaim and the... there were giants in the land. We see in Deuteronomy chapter 2 that they conquered some of them in earlier in Numbers. We also see in Joshua that they conquer both Joshua and Caleb conquer the Anakim at the time. So they are all connected in some sense. So they all are involved in that. So they come back in some form. The Rephaim come back as giants. God is here telling, or Moses is writing with the inspiration of God, saying, God destroyed them in the flood. Those that have come back who are like the Nephilim from of old, Abraham took care of them with took care of the people who conquered them with 318 soldiers. My word. Does that build one's faith? Does that build one's faith? For the people, for the Israelites wandering in the wilderness, does that build them up and say, hey, you, God, are capable of doing this. If you can do that with 318 men, surely we can do it with 600,000, which is how many fighting men they had at the time. That's the reason why this is mentioned. Who these are, the Nephilim, the sons of God, the daughters of men, ultimately, we can speculate all day long. But the reason why it's here is to build faith in God. And to show, yes, God is, to coin a phrase from VeggieTales, God is bigger than the boogeyman. All right. Do you have a thought before we close out? Yeah.
There are plenty in history, in recent recorded history, and even in modern times, there are plenty of people who are classified as giants. I have been classified as one most of my adult life. Selective breeding can do that.
Yeah.
Okay? There's a reason why most tall people marry short people. And one of them is they don't want to have 8-foot-tall children. There's a reason, because genetics will do that. But the thing is, there are plenty of people today that would be classified as giants in Old Testament terminology. There are no fallen angels going around marrying women to produce them.
Yeah.
And so there's a completely natural explanation for this.
Right.
And I think any time that you run up against something that is a little bit, scratch your head about, a natural explanation trumps like crazy some of these crazy websites that say, oh, we were like grasshoppers in their eyes, so they had to be 450 feet tall. And there are some that say that. It is that nuts.
Well, of course, that's in Numbers 13 again, and that is very likely, well, no, that is an exaggeration.
But that's the point. It was hyperbole to say how they were feeling.
Yeah.
But people will go to all kinds of crazy lengths to take these things because they create sensational stories. It's not that this has anything to do with God's help, except don't worry about him. God's going to take care of him, which is a great message. It's just simply, that's one of those things that was there. We don't have a lot of information. Spending a huge amount of time trying to build out a complete explanation of it outside of what you've done, which I think is a fine study, is really wasting your time.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting.
Yes, it is interesting.
The Bible, I think it's sure. important for us to read it.
Yeah.
The Bible, understand it.
The main point of Sam's comment for those online is that there is a perfectly natural explanation for large folk like the giants, and so we don't need to resort to these fantastical explanations. Alvin and then Art.
Quick question. Chronologically, the flood in relationship to ancient Egypt. So Egypt would have been after the flood.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I think that there may have been. So I think some speculate that the that nothing of mankind survived the flood. I don't think that's necessary. I don't think we have to be that dogmatic about it. Certainly, mankind itself did not survive, but the things that mankind left behind may have, depending on certain certain aspects. It's possible. And so there may have been some aspect that was left behind that perhaps people of Mizraim, who are descendants of Ham, took over that land in Egypt and became what we consider the Egyptians today, or not today, but the ancient Egyptians. So that's a possibility. The pyramids were built before Abraham, though. We're pretty certain about that. Yes.
Yeah, I went and saw the pyramids 2005 and Luxor and all that. And I was told that they were about 5,000, 6,000 feet.
Yeah.
So I was trying to establish.
Where, yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting. That's one of those mysteries that we're just not entirely sure about. Art.
On television, on the news, they were showing where a guy was taller than the people was walking around. It's some sort of genetic.
So yeah, there are some genetic disorders that cause people to fall into what's called giantism. A malfunctioning pituitary gland, the thing that governs the growth hormone in your brain. If it's not functioning properly, you could potentially get really tall. But it has side effects, and so I doubt that they would become the men of renown if they had fallen to malfunctioning pituitary gland. All right, any other thoughts or comments? We're a little over time, but that's okay. All right. Thank you for comments, questions, and we'll start a new live stream in a little while.